It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the National Park Service has a to-do list with a maintenance backlog of $11 billion. That includes some Wisconsin sites, including the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, home to 9 lighthouses. We'll find out how the funding shortfall could affect the Lake Superior landmarks. First, the state Senate is in session today, and one of the most watched items on their agenda was whether the heads of the state's ethics and elections commissions would lose their jobs. Mike Haas has been head of the Elections Commission. Brian Bell has been the administrator for the Ethics Commission. But Republican senators are targeting them for their jobs. WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson has been following the issue. He's at the Capitol now. Sean, welcome back.
Hi, Rob.
Well, the results are they voted against both of them. Is that right?
That is correct. 18 to 13 votes against both Mike Haas and Brian Bell. And those were party line votes. You had all Republicans voting against their confirmation or, you know, voting to fire them, essentially, and all Democrats supporting Bell and Haas.
We'll get into the why in just a minute, but let's start with what happens next for those two and their jobs.
So that is up for debate at this point. The head of the Ethics Commission told the Wisconsin State Journal this afternoon after the vote that now that this vote has taken place, they're going to consider legal action. So we don't know what that means, but we do know that there are some backers of Bell and Haas who feel like they answer to those boards. They don't answer to the Wisconsin State Senate. And those boards unanimously supported and continue to support Bell and Haas. So the thinking is that as long as they're happy, they can't be fired. The Wisconsin State Senate, specifically Republicans who run the Wisconsin State Senate, have a different view of things. They say that these appointments, like any others, serve with the advice and consent of the Senate. The Senate weighed in on them today and voted against their confirmation, so they believe that's the end of the story. But it sounds like there could be potentially a legal fight over this. We just don't know.
Has anybody gone back to the laws creating the Ethics and Elections Commission and said, hey, this really spells it out really clearly one way or the other?
I think that'd be what gets spelled out if there is indeed a court fight. But that would also, I mean, I guess the case against that is the courts would view it as that it could be a separation of powers there. If the legislature can't weigh in on, advice and consent like this, if they can't weigh in on an appointment, the courts could view that as a separation of powers issue.
And who appointed Haas and Bell initially?
The boards, these commissions, the Ethics and Elections Commissions, when they were formed, they were given the power to pick their administrators, and they chose Bell and Haas. And, you know, Haas in particular had, they both had histories at the Government Accountability Board. Haas had a longer history there. He'd been the top, he'd been head of the elections division at the old Government Accountability Board. So his history was well known, but his expertise was well known too. And so you had this fledgling agency that was formed as one of the agencies to replace the Government Accountability Board. The commissioners picked Haas because he understands Wisconsin's election system. Bell didn't have quite as much history there, but he had also worked in the GAB before he took this job. And again, he was hired by the Ethics Commission. Both of those commissions are staffed, or I guess they're run by an even mix of Republican and Democratic appointees.
Talking to WPR's Sean Johnson, he's over at the state capitol looking at the Senate votes this afternoon to not confirm the heads of the Elections Commission and the Ethics Commission in Wisconsin. So getting into the why, Sean, it goes back to the history, right, that you were just talking about. We had scandals in Wisconsin government. The legislature created the Government Accountability Board. The legislature, Republicans in particular, in the legislature felt the Government Accountability Board wasn't as nonpartisan as it was supposed to be. They ended it, replaced it with this Ethics Commission and Elections Commission. But the bad blood, apparently, over the GAB, the Government Accountability Board, has not gone away.
That is absolutely correct. And, I mean, we had a report that was released in December by Republican Attorney General Brad Schimmel, and that was looking specifically into leaks that came out of the John Doe 2 investigation that was conducted in part by the Government Accountability Board, and that investigation was looking into whether Governor Scott Walker's campaign illegally coordinated with conservative groups during the recall elections. That investigation was shut down. The Wisconsin Supreme Court said that coordination was legal, but the bad blood from that continued among Republicans. But I think if you listen to debate on the Senate floor today, there was really no doubt that, Bell and Haas weren't fired because they were named in this report. They were fired because they were part of the Government Accountability Board. And Senator Fitzgerald, the majority leader, said repeatedly that he wasn't going to have confidence in them leading that agency when they were part of the GAB during that John Doe. And that was kind of the end of the story for him, that the Department of Justice investigation into those leaks did kind of bring it all back to the surface, but that he never had confidence in them leading those agencies. Haas kind of disputed that on social media today, said that he'd been in conversations with Fitzgerald, and Fitzgerald never told him that, he wasn't long for leading that agency.
And Republicans, it sounds like we're saying some of them, they felt unfairly targeted in those John Doe investigations, personally targeted, personal information collected and left vulnerable. What kind of things did we hear from Republican senators on those lines?
I think that was it. Because that investigation was so sweeping, it involved so many Republican groups. If you look at the Department of Justice report on the investigation of the investigation, it shows how many people were subpoenaed as part of that probe, how many groups and people. And the list is definitely long, and you recognize a lot of the names. They've worked in state government in one form or another as a staffer or a lobbyist or a legislator. It was definitely a sweeping probe. And so this is something that, Republicans haven't forgotten about.
And what did Democrats have to say in voting against this, or in voting for the confirmation, I guess?
Yeah, a few things. One thing that they really kept coming back to is that Haas and Bell were never actually given a chance to state their case to the public. They were never given public hearings. That always happens with confirmations. They're always given a chance to have a public hearing where their supporters could come forward and say, what's good about Mike Haas and Brian Bell, and it would give them a chance to answer criticisms in a public way. That didn't happen. But the other thing they said was, why are we spending so much time talking about kind of how the John Doe investigation went instead of what it turned up? And, we know that the Supreme Court said that John Doe investigation was closed. They said you can coordinate within these independent groups. The legislature passed a law that said, after the court acted, the legislature passed a law and said, you can do this. You can coordinate in Wisconsin. But before all that happened, there was information coming out in leaks showing that Governor Walker's campaign was coordinating extensively with third-party groups that can accept unlimited donations and keep their donors secret. There was a lot that came out as part of the John Doe. Democrats pointed that out. They also said this is not a good time in an election year, a month into an election year, to be getting rid of the person who knows more about elections than anybody in Wisconsin, Mike Haas. It's going to be a busy year for both of these commissions, and now the experts who are in charge of running them are, if the Senate's vote holds, out of a job.
And if these bipartisan ethics and elections boards do challenge the Senate here and say, no, it's our job to hire and fire, it'll be up in the air as to whether we have a head of an elections commission for as long as that court battle takes, much less replacing him if he is ultimately left out of the job?
I'm not sure we know what exactly happens next. I can tell you right before we talked, Brian Bell spoke briefly with reporters, and it sounded like he wasn't sure exactly what he'd be doing, whether he'd be coming into work tomorrow, what the commission, the full commission, wanted to see from this. So there's a lot of unknowns here. For the commissions, there's the question of, how do we fight this? How long would that take? How long are we kind of in limbo? And, if they were to lose the fight, then they have the question of who do we put in their place, what kind of a nominee is going to not get rejected by the Senate when Haas and Bell, were along party lines.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He joined us to give us an update on the GOP lawmakers' attempts to oust the heads of the state's Ethics and Elections Commissions. Republican senators voted not to confirm both of them in their posts. Right now, the National Park Service faces an $11 billion maintenance backlog in its more than 42,000 properties. This includes some Wisconsin sites, like the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. We'll first talk to a reporter about where Wisconsin sites stand with maintenance. Then we'll talk to two lighthouse experts for a look at the significance of the Lake Superior landmarks. Danielle Kading is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. She's based in Superior. Danny, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Happy Tuesday.
Well, you reported on this national story, this backlog of maintenance at the Park Service. Where is that affecting us here in Wisconsin?
Most of that is being seen roll out on the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. They are home to 9 lighthouses, the most of any national park in the nation. And they just have trouble keeping up with some of these historic structures. And they've also had trouble with docks and trails and just regular maintenance that needs to be done on the islands, of which there are 21.
And how does this play out then? Is the head of the Apostle Islands Park facing off with colleagues around the country to try to get up in this queue for backlog funding?
Yeah, well, definitely they're all competing with each other as far as funding goes. But generally, the National Park Service has been able to provide funding for that. Or, you know, in some cases, they've been able to make improvements to some of these light stations under the term of historic preservation, because a number of them are quite old. And they were able to get some funding from Congress back around 7 or 8 years ago to help restore some of these lighthouses and, you know, just do regular maintenance like on the roof or clear out any hazardous substances, stuff like that.
And we don't have anything called a national park in Wisconsin, but we have national forests and lakeshores and trails. What are some of the other areas that could be affected by a backlog in maintenance funding?
Well, the St. Croix National Scenic Riverway, which is located in eastern Minnesota, northwestern Wisconsin, they also are seeing a little bit of a backlog. They have a backlog of around $1.4 million, and that basically has to do with regular maintenance of their campsites and river landings and boat lots. So that's the kind of stuff that they're seeing. Or, you know, just maybe if they, for example, have a building and they need to upgrade the heating and cooling, it all adds up.
And is there any idea how this, if they're ever going to catch up with this backlog at the national level and then at Apostle Islands and elsewhere in the state?
Well, you know, I think some of the idea is people are kind of watching to see what might happen with this infrastructure bill that Trump has been talking a lot about, investing in infrastructure nationwide, President Trump. And a lot of the maintenance that needs to be done in the national parks has to do with roads. I think around $6 billion of it is basically restoring roads and buildings at the national parks. So if you see any kind of federal funds come down for infrastructure improvements across the country, that might help national parks that, you know, at least the ones that have that $4 billion worth of road repairs that need to get done. Otherwise, I think it's you just kind of are taking care of things as you prioritize them and as you can.
And Danny, we're going to take a closer look at these lighthouses in just a minute. But if I can switch gears for a moment, I understand the ice caves still not open up there. Are you looking forward to getting out to the caves if and when they do open this year?
You know, I will be happy to freeze my butt off if they do open. I'll trek out there along with everyone else. Actually, I haven't been out there before. The first time that they froze over, I wasn't out there. So I'd be really happy to go if they form. But it looks like it's going to be a warm weekend and the ice has blown out into the lake again. So we'll just keep watching it and see what happens.
All right, Danny, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. She's based in Superior. She joined us to talk about a National Park Service's maintenance backlog and how it affects Wisconsin. And we talked a lot there about the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore as a site with maintenance needs, in part because of the 9 lighthouses there. Ken and Barb Wardius are co-authors of Wisconsin Lighthouses, a photographic and historical guide. They travel nationally as lighthouse lecturers, and they belong to a lot of organizations dedicated to the preservation of lighthouses. Barb, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Our pleasure. Thank you.
And Ken, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, Rob. Thank you.
Well, let's talk about the significance of these lighthouses at the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. Barb, why don't you jump in first? Tell us why these are a big deal for us here in Wisconsin.
They are historic sites. They are very important to our rich maritime history in Wisconsin. Lighthouses all over the world, as you probably know, are threatened, but these are especially in danger because of the lack of funds. And anyone that owns a home knows what maintenance costs are like. So we're certainly hoping for the best.
And Ken, can you talk about the history of our lighthouses in the Apostle Islands?
Well, as you mentioned before, Rob, there's 21 islands. This is a very important part of Lake Superior as Europeans move westward. The Sioux Locks and the Sault Ste. Marie were opened in 1855, so this was the last portion of the western section of Lake Superior that would be colonized and eventually be very important shipping routes. So the nine lighthouses from Ashland to the Apostle Islands to Superior, these were the routes that goods would travel. Those were the modern superhighways of that time. Before railroads were built, many goods went via ships, via these large ships. And with all the different islands in the Apostle area, there were many hazards, of course. So many, many lighthouses were in need of being built.
Can you talk, Barb, a little bit about the life of the lighthouse keeper? I know they were automated after a time. Now we don't rely on lighthouses like we used to. But in their heyday, what was the lighthouse keeper doing?
Sure, of course. Early on, there were positions that were usually political in nature. If you were a Civil War veteran, you may be appointed to a lighthouse if you had some aptitude in maintenance and obviously boating and that kind of thing. The day-to-day life was mundane at best. It's a government job, so you're strictly regulated. Mariners depended very, very much on the lighthouses being lit properly every evening. So, of course, the lighthouse keeper was responsible for the care and lighting of the lamp every night. During the day, he would be cleaning. He would be polishing the brass, getting all the soot off the glass French-made Fresnel lens to get it ready for the night. In between, there was probably painting and cleaning. They were also able to hunt and fish to provide food. They were always busy doing something.
And Ken, let's look at a couple of particular lighthouses on the islands. I understand Raspberry Island is one of the most visited. What can you tell us about the lighthouse there?
Raspberry is just one of our favorites, Rob. It is the most visited. If you go to the Apostle Islands cruise service, in Bayfield, spring through fall, they offer various boat trips. Raspberry is spectacular. You know, we had mentioned before some of the maintenance issues at some of the lighthouses in the Apostles. Raspberry is really kind of the standard of what the others should look like. There have been some monies allocated over the years for renovation and restoration. Raspberry Island is a very large complex. In addition to the keeper's house and the light tower itself, many stations had other structures. There's a large boathouse on Raspberry Island, a fuel building, the privy, what's known as, it's a fancy name for an outhouse, but it's a very spacious station, and the National Park Service has done a really nice job over the last several decades of shoring it up and doing the maintenance that we talked about that's so much needed at some of the other lights. It's in the period of not quite a century ago, in the 1920s or so. They also staffed the park there with National Park Service docents, also some volunteers. So if there's any lighthouse in the Apostles we would recommend visiting, it would be Raspberry because of the maintenance and the restoration that's gone on over the years.
And Barb, I think of the life of the keeper as being really solitary, but I understand there were families there. Sand Island was home to a keeper couple for a while.
Yes, Sand Island was built in 1881, and one of the earlier keepers there was Emmanuel Luick and his wife Ella. They married when she was 16. And on that island, there happened to be a fishing village and just some regular settlers on the island as well. So they did have a bit of a social life. However, the logbooks tell us that after about 10 years, Miss Ella simply had enough of lighthouse life, and she left the island never to return. They did divorce a year later, but Mr. Lewis did remarry, having four children, and he stayed in the lighthouse service for almost 30 years, so he must have liked his job very, very much.
And Ken, can you talk about the benefits of having these lighthouses still standing in good repair and accessible to the public as far as what we learn about our history there?
Yeah, Barb and I are huge proponents of maritime history, as she mentioned. We grew up in Milwaukee. We're fortunate to be near Lake Michigan. Mm-hmm. As we got a little older, we appreciated, I think, history, you know, much better. The Apostle Islands really is a special area, not only in Wisconsin, but in western Lake Superior. Now, these were very important shipping routes, as I mentioned, very important to the development, you know, the Bayfield, you know, Ashland, LaPointe on Madeline Island, Duluth and Superior. So they historically, they're very important. It talks about, you know, Wisconsin's history, Wisconsin's culture, things back then. Yes, they were different than today. Some of the many things we take for granted today, you know, we're not present then. But it's really they're nice remnants of the past, and it's important, we think, to remember that history, remember that part of Wisconsin's past.
We'll leave it there for now. Ken and Barb, thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you, Rob.
Ken and Barb Wardius are co-authors of Wisconsin Lighthouses, a photographic and historical guide. They joined us to talk about the stories and history of the lighthouses on the Apostle Island National Lakeshore. First, a new production brings the experience of women who have spent time in prison to the stage. The Power of Grace is a creation of Chicago's Still Point Theater. It's based on poetry written by formerly incarcerated women and performed by the women themselves. This Saturday at 6:30 p.m., the Fox Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship Church in Appleton is hosting a performance and a discussion with the cast. The show is free and open to the public. Mars Calton is the facilitator for Still Point Theater and a teaching artist for Grace House in Chicago. Mars, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, good afternoon.
And Heather Rivett is a cast member in The Power of Grace. Heather, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Mars, give us an idea of what people can expect from The Power of Grace. What would we see?
You're going to see a handful of women who have been involved with the Persephone Project, which works with, it's a project of Still Point Theater, and it works with women who are either currently or formerly incarcerated. And particularly the work that is being performed in this program is going to be work that was written during the spring of 2017 with the women specifically from Grace House.
And Heather, you are...
So you're going to see some spoken word poetry, and you'll and there'll be, you know, in acting.
And Heather, you were incarcerated for 2 years. You're participating in this project now. Can you talk about some of the emotions that you coped with while incarcerated and that you wrote about in this project?
Yeah, definitely. For me, it was, my first time being incarcerated for that long, and anxiety played a big role. I mean, it was like feeling betrayed and feeling shamed and, you know, not accepted in society by your family and stuff like that. It's very emotional. But working with Still Point and learning how to deal with that and put it into a new light, it's been fun. And like, speaking in front of people is my worst fear, but working with Mars specifically, like, she makes it so easy. So it's been a great experience.
What was it like to write down your feelings, I think, in poetry form, and then to get up in front of people and share that?
Well, like I said, it's my worst fear, so it was definitely nerve-wracking. But it was very empowering, especially getting feedback from people like, wow, we really enjoyed that, and thanks for sharing. You know, like, you never know who you're going to help sharing experiences, because people who have been through stuff who might be afraid to talk about it, it's not so much the differences but the similarities that you share with people. And I always say, if I can help at least one person, I'll feel successful.
Mars, can you tell us how the idea for this production came about?
Well, we worked for about 4 months, meeting weekly, myself and the women at Grace House. And we did various themes, a different theme every week, of what kind of things we wanted to write about. And we would take pieces and edit them. Sometimes people wanted to team up on a piece. Sometimes we had a whole lot of small pieces that didn't really say that much on their own, but then we put them together into larger group pieces. And one of the finale of the show is actually the recording of about 12 to 16 of the women, each putting in pieces of the poem, the finale poem that they all wrote.
And Mars, this is
so
part of
Still
Point Theater's Persephone project. Can you explain the Persephone project and what it is?
Yes, that's a project that has been in existence for a few years. It works with women that are either currently in prison or have been formerly incarcerated. The women at Grace House are all women who are formerly incarcerated, some of whom are still on parole, and we work at the house doing spoken word and acting.
We're talking to Mars Calton, a facilitator for Still Point Theater, teaching artist for Grace House in Chicago, and Heather Rivett, cast member in The Power of Grace. It's a performance, a poetry written by women who were formerly incarcerated. There's an appearance coming up this weekend in Appleton. And Heather, why do you think it's important for people to hear these stories, to understand the experiences of women in prison?
Like I said before, if you're sharing something that other people might be afraid to share, you never know who in the audience is listening that you're going to help relieve some stress or help give a voice to somebody else. Luckily, I've had awesome support, my girlfriend, my family, you know, the girls here at Grace House. But I think just getting the word out about women formerly incarcerated and some of the things that go on inside that people don't know about, shedding some light on that and hopefully making a better future for women is what the ultimate decision change should be.
And Heather, this is informing other people. Do you feel like you've learned something about yourself and your own experience by doing this?
Absolutely. My first performance, one of my first responses from an audience member was, "Oh my gosh, how long have you been doing this?" And I was like, "Oh my gosh, I've really only been doing this for like 4 weeks." So it was like really awesome. You know, it felt really good that people enjoyed something that I thought I was scared to do. In all actuality, from the feedback I've gotten, I hope that I'm really great. So it's an awesome experience. I look forward to the future.
And Mars, I understand the performance this weekend is followed by a question and answer session with the cast. What kind of discussions have come out of the past performances so far?
Well, one of the things that keeps coming up is how transformative these shows are. They transform the women they give that perform. It's been an opportunity for them to work through some feelings about life, either before, during, or after their prison experience, helps them overcome some fears and some boundaries, like Heather was talking about. But it also transforms people in the audience, because I think that we tend to have a them and us kind of viewpoint when we think about people that have been through the prison system. And when we start hearing some of these stories, we start finding pieces that connect to what we've gone through in our lives. And we can really start making connections between, well, what is a shared human experience, and just the details are different. And it really affects people in the audiences, and so a lot of people bring that up during the question and answer period. And I think we've also, a lot of people, they don't really know and they don't have an opportunity to talk to somebody who is saying, "You can ask me about things, and I'm letting you know that I've been through the prison system, and what would you like to know about that?" And people ask questions about that. And that's an opportunity for the audience as well.
And Mars, I think a lot of times if we think about education programs in prison, it's vocational, it's job training, that kind of thing. How important do you think a creative outlet is like this for someone who's incarcerated or just out of prison?
I think this is one of the greatest kinds of gifts that we can offer people, because it allows them to learn new ways to express themselves, to speak up for themselves, and to work as a team and as a group. And these are things that people may or may not always have, depending on what their life's journey has been like. But when you're talking about performing as an ensemble, there's a lot of teamwork and a lot of skill involved in doing that. And with our creative director, who is an actor from Chicago Shakespeare Theater, his name is Hector Pasquale, and he has really helped us to learn how to read each other's cues, do collective timing, and these are all things that are community building, not just amongst the ensemble, but these are skills that will transfer to people's abilities to return to families that they've been separated from, perhaps, return to jobs, return to their communities as stronger individuals.
And Heather, you mentioned you've never done this kind of performance before. Had you written poetry before this program?
Yes. Actually, I love to write, and that is one of my best coping skills aside from music. So writing has always been a thing of mine, but I've never quite understood all everything about poetry. I never understood everything, but the way that we work with Stillpoint and how they break stuff down, how they teach us different strategies, even in the acting part of it, you know, it's just, it's an experience. It's something different. I enjoy it.
And Mars, before we let you go, there's this performance in Appleton this weekend. Are you working on more performances and maybe working with a new group of women who have been incarcerated?
We are looking forward to that. We worked 4 months straight last year, and then we went into some rehearsals, and then I think this is about our fifth performance. And we will be starting up again, you know, funding willing to be able to continue this project with Grace House so that we can involve more women, because as a transitional house, women do come and go. And we're looking forward to being able to continue so we can bring more people to do more writing and start working on a brand new show and a new ensemble.
Mars, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having us.
And Heather, have a great show in Appleton.
Thanks so much.
We've been talking to Mars Calton, facilitator for Stillpoint Theater, and Heather Rivett, a cast member in The Power of Grace. They'll be part of a free performance this Saturday evening at 6:30 p.m. It's at the Fox Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship Church in Appleton. Right now, Jolly Ranchers is hair gel, colored pencils as eyeshadow, book covers used as blush. These are all beauty hacks used by female inmates, past and present. While critics may question why makeup is necessary for an inmate while serving time, our next guest says beauty products can help inmates keep a sense of their identities and their humanity while behind bars. Marilyn Komar is a writer who covers fashion and beauty history, feminism, style, and travel. Her piece, Why Makeup Matters to Women in Prison, appeared on racked.com. Marilyn, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I think if people think about the experience of women in prison, makeup might not be high on the list. Why is it so important, though?
So I found the interesting thing about researching this piece is that it really connects back to women's history. So usually, like in modern times, when we think of makeup, we think of women putting it on to be more beautiful, but not necessarily for themselves, but for the public. So when you hear of women in prison putting on makeup, it's a little bit confusing to some because they think of they're indoors, they don't have visitors, you know, they are locked up with other women, so why should they be beautiful? But the reason that it links back is because it connects back to choice and to autonomy.
So the idea is that makeup for women in prison and maybe women not in prison too isn't necessarily just for other people to look at. It's a self-expression and identity.
Right, yeah. And the really the way that it connects back to prison is that women in prison, the important thing to remember is that women in the penitentiary have been abused and traumatized for most of their lives. So a lot of the time when they use makeup, they use it as a way to rebuild themselves and to get back their sense of self-worth.
And you trace some of the history of what women in prisons over the years have done, given that they don't have access to makeup in prison. Can you talk about some of the history behind what women in prison have done to make up for that lack of makeup?
Yeah, so in 1908, one woman created blush by pulling out the red stitching from her government-issued nightgown, and then she soaked the threads in water and then dabbed that stain onto her cheeks. So she basically made blush by pulling out these red strings from her nightdress.
And you write that stymied the prison guards. They couldn't figure out where she was getting blush.
Yeah, so the warden started losing his mind because during that time, Russian ballet was really popular, and, like, this one inmate, she kept having, like, these ballerina-like cheeks. Like, she would have, like, these red circles on her cheeks, and he couldn't figure out how she got this contraband inside. So it took them a couple of weeks where the guards had to kind of keep an eye on her and figure out how she was doing it, and they found out that very patiently, very slowly, she would be picking out these threads and then slowly soaking them water and then using it as a stain for rouge.
And you write about other creative solutions over the years. What other kinds of things have we seen?
So in that same prison, this was a prison in Milan, women also, they used to make face powder by licking the walls of their cells, and then they would chew the lime dust to make white paste, and they would dab that onto their faces as face powder. Or there was another woman who would regularly break the prison rules so she could be sent down to confinement, where she stole wire from a window grate to make a corset. And the only way they found out she had that corset was that one day she put it on too tightly and she passed out in the chapel. And they had to, like, take off her dress, and they were like, oh, what is this? But then in 1946 in Ottawa, for example, incarcerated women picked out prison books in red binding, and they soaked the covers to use the red stain as blush or lipstick. Or then in the 1970s in Bedford Hills, women would dip a finger into toothpaste and they would rub it into colored picture in a magazine and use the pigment as eyeshadow.
And Marilyn,
but there was like,
oop, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead, sorry.
Generally now, do prisons allow women to have access to some or all forms of beauty care products?
They do. So the majority of prison on the commissary list, they allow from 3 to 5 different makeup items, and they would span from just normal everyday things, so like lip gloss, a very limited foundation, eyeshadow, stuff like that. But women would use fake up hacks, so essentially DIY hacks, to make up for the things that the commissary list was lacking.
And there's been pushback at times when that was made available to women. Can you talk about that?
Right. So in a lot of my research, I tried to mostly research history-related things. But when I would read the newer articles, you know, like the first fake up hack article was featured in 2014 on the Marshall Project. And a lot of the comments on those articles would be people angry that prison is allowing inmates to have these things that are thought of as a luxury. So they were wondering, you know, these people broke the law. This isn't a vacation. They shouldn't be made to feel good about themselves, that they should be, you know, punished in this prison setting rather than given mascara wands and, you know, hairspray and stuff like that. But a lot of the times, I think what the issue is the public doesn't realize that the women that are incarcerated, they come from a very long setting of abuse and trauma. So, for example, like if you look at the statistics, to allow them to have this sense of self-care, to have this outlet of self-care, it helps to rebuild their sense of worth. And once they get out of prison, and they will get out of prison, 98% of inmates do leave the penitentiary and they do get go back into society. You know, like you want them to be more functioning and, you know, a better citizen overall.
Talking to Marilyn Komar, she wrote recently about makeup in women's prisons. And Marilyn, that last point you're making gets really to the heart of what you're looking at, what people might see as kind of a trivial thing in prisons. What do we want prisons to do to and or for the people who are in them? Can you talk about that?
Right. So as I was saying with the statistics on women, so as I said, most of them have been abused in their lifetime. So almost 90% of women in the system have experienced sexual abuse and violence, and most during their childhoods. And in a very real way, their past puts them on a direct path towards incarceration, so much so that Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey called it the survivor of sexual trauma to prison pipeline. So if you look at the breakdown, an overwhelming 86% are sexual abuse survivors. 60% that are incarcerated have experienced caregiver violence, and over 90% of women who are convicted of murdering a partner were victims of partner abuse. And then to take it further, 32% that are incarcerated right now have serious mental illnesses, and 82% are suffering drug or alcohol addiction, which oftentimes is used as self-medication in order to cope with the side effects of their past. And if you think that these statistics don't create a domino effect, you're wrong, because those with histories of abuse are 77% more likely to be arrested than women who did not suffer that kind of trauma.
And by and large, as you research this, does the prison experience of women reflect that? Does it orient itself toward treating the consequences of that abuse and the things that follow that?
So it depends from state to state. So, for example, I personally interviewed, I'm from Chicago, so I interviewed Deanne Benos, who's the founder of Women's Justice Initiative in Chicago, which works to address the lack of gender-responsive practices for women throughout the criminal justice system. And, I mean, she had a ton of cases where in Illinois, the people that work in the prison system, instead of helping to rebuild these women that have landed in prison, they further break them down. So, for example, there was one example. So when in Logan in Illinois, it was converted into a women's prison, and they herded the women together in buses from the other prison and lined them up outside. And the person that was in charge of the lines that day was telling the women, like, you women are nasty, you're a bunch of smelly whores, you're disgusting. And it's just like constant words that challenge your self-esteem. And that wasn't an isolated incident. That was just one out of a thousand. So these women that are inside the prison, they're just further torn down rather than helped to be rebuilt.
And you wrote about one example that kind of flipped this around and made beauty care an opportunity for women, a hair salon in a prison in the 1950s. The idea is, hey, we'll give women access to makeup and beauty products and maybe some job training skills for when they get out.
Right. So that's actually, so when you read articles and they actually, like in the here and now, when you read articles and they mention beauty salons in prison, like those aren't beauty salons just so, you know, women who are incarcerated could get their hair done. Those are vocational training projects. So when there is a, what that is to basically teach these women how to be hairstylists. So when they leave prison, they have that opportunity, which makes sense because, like, for example, when I mentioned in the 1950s, women who would leave that Greenwich Village prison, they would only have about 25 cents in cash to their name, which is a little over $2 in today's times. So, I mean, if you're let go out of prison that day, you don't even have enough money for transportation, for food, for lodging. So having a vocational training under your belt, that helps you to reincorporate into society a lot faster. And that's what we're doing now. So in men's prisons, they have barbershops. In women's prisons, they have hair salons. They have nail technicians. And that's all to teach them to have, like, a vocational practice when they leave.
We'll leave it there for now. Marilyn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Marilyn Komar is a writer who covers fashion and beauty history. She joined us to talk about her piece, Why Makeup Matters to Women in Prison.